I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Perhaps we can save the world by going to the mall. You read Bruce Philp's new book, Consumer Republic, Using Brands to Get What You Want, Make Corporations Behave, and Maybe Even Save the World, and you get a convincing argument you can. Brands are the weapon we consumers wield. The corporations value their brands, spend much to create them, and more money to protect them. We can use brands to our advantage, telling companies what we want, what we value, and what we want in this world. Bruce Philp joins me now. For 30 years or more, he was in the advertising business. He co-wrote the best-selling The Orange Code, How ING Direct Succeeded by Being a Rebel with a Cause. He has a couple of websites, brandcowboy.com, where you can read his blog, as well as brucephilp.com. He joins me from here in Vancouver this day. Consumer Republic is published by McClelland & Stewart. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Bruce Philp. Good morning, Mr. Philp.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Have we always had this power over the corporation? It just seems that lately it's after reading the book, I realize it much more than I did, say, before I read the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think in one fundamental sense, we've always had this power insofar as we always had the choice of whether to give them our money or not. What has changed in the last couple of decades has been that we are harder for them to talk to because of the revolution that's occurred in media. And that very same revolution has created a situation in which media are two-way, so we can actually talk back. And that has occurred at about the same time as corporations that sell to us became a little less involved in the making of things and a little more involved in the branding of things. And so you put those two things together, a population that has the power to talk back and do so publicly, and an industry that is depending more on its reputation than on its products, and you have a significant power shift.
Now, you've worked in the advertising side of the business, so you know corporations very well. Mm-hmm. Do they want to hear what we have to say?
Oh, they absolutely do. They may not all like it or be equally responsive, but there's nothing, I think, that terrifies a corporation more than silence.
And is it just social media where this influence manifests itself?
Well, that seems to be the thing that people attach themselves to when they're trying to grasp this concept, because it's easy to understand. And corporations are, you know, by some accounts, 80% of the Fortune 500 are actively involved in surveilling social media. But it is a little bit bigger than that. We, for example, have the power to simply not show up. What makes that different than not buying a product 20 or 30 years ago is that corporations can observe quite quickly when our behavior has changed. There's a story in the book about Walmart delisting a number of packaged goods brands at the end of 2009, and consumers handing them their first negative growth quarter in history at the end of that year, and by the middle of February of 2010, they were apologizing and returning those products to the shelves. That's very responsive behavior, and it occurred without any active social media kind of participation. So we're just generally being watched and measured more carefully, and that's producing a more responsive corporation. And then the power extends even to media, where we have so much choice now about what we watch that we can punish or reward an advertiser simply by engaging or not engaging in the channels through which they're advertising.
I'm interested in statistics that you might have in terms of whether people buy brands or not. Say, like, I go to Costco, and if I go to Costco, I should say, and I want to get ibuprofen, I would probably get the generic brand rather than Advil. And what's the breakdown in terms of people that are like me? Are you like that?
Well, no. Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty dedicated to the to what brands can do for us. So I tend to avoid no names just on principle.
Right.
The extent to which generic products are sold varies widely from category to category. So, in other words, there's no single percentage that applies across the spectrum. People are going to behave differently when they're buying snow tires than when they're buying breakfast cereal than when they're buying beer than when they're buying color television sets. So it's pretty difficult to generalize. What you find when you dig into it is that people's attachment to brands tends to go along with risk. So the more disastrous a mistake might be, or the more they want to know that a corporation is going to be accountable if that brand lets them down, the more likely they are to gravitate to brands.
And I brought up the example of pain relievers, because you have in the book the story of what happened to Tylenol. I guess this was, in the early 80s?
In the early 80s, yeah.
Yeah. So some lunatic had started, I guess it was in Chicago, right? I can't remember.
That's correct.
Yeah. Started putting, poison in the bottles in shops, right?
Yeah, cyanide.
Yeah, and people died, and then Tylenol's response was what? I mean, they had nothing to do with it.
No, that's right, and so that example is a little less obvious than some others might be. But I thought it was a very important way of demonstrating what a brand actually does for consumers, because McNeil Consumer Products, who make and continue to make that brand, were extremely aggressive about dealing with the problem that they had. They were very transparent in the media. BP could have learned a few things from them. They were quick and sure about innovating, package security features and security features for the capsules, and pulling products off the shelf at great cost to them. And they kind of wrote the book on crisis management in public relations. And my contention in Consumer Republic is that they did this because their brand was at stake. They may have done it because they were good people. I'm sure that they are. And there was all kinds of humanity in that motivation. But at the end of the day, this is a corporation. And corporations exist to build value for their shareholders. And that value was going to be threatened by a population of 350 million people who were never going to trust that name again when they saw it on a drugstore shelf. So my belief is that they're doing the right thing had a great deal to do with the need to restore the value in that reputation. And that's why, although you might be comfortable buying generic ibuprofen at Costco, and you'll probably be entirely satisfied with the product, I'm not, because I want to know that someone with something to lose made this product that I'm about to put into my body.
And you say that in the book, that it's easier to sue, say, Tylenol or Advil or aspirin than save the Life brand or Kirkland or whatever.
That's right. Yeah. I think store brands have they certainly have more freedom to just kind of make a product disappear if there's a problem with it without any significant threat to the total value of their franchise, where traditional brands have a lot to lose and they're probably going to defend it. My speculation at the end of the book is that this is one of the reasons why BP wore the entirety of the oil spill problem in the Gulf of Mexico, however responsible they were, and I think we know now that they were quite responsible. It was clearly politically a smart move to pin this on them, because of all the people who were involved in that disaster, they were the only ones that had a consumer brand at stake.
And this also speaks to the consumer wanting authenticity, whatever authenticity is. Did you find there's a great demand for that?
Yeah, people. It's funny. The word is getting pretty well worn these days, and it means different things to different people. But I am convinced that we all still want to know that the thing we're buying is legitimate. Because we don't want to, we too have something at risk, and that has something to do with not wanting to be made fools of.
The importance of consuming sustainably is something that comes across in the book, and that's one of your goals, I guess, in sort of remaking how we think about brands. Is it because it's something in vogue, or is it because it's something that people truly want because it's good?
Well, certainly the subject is in vogue, no doubt about it, and I'm absolutely taking advantage of that here. But the problem that I have with a lot of sustainable consumption is that it's more about social badge than it is about really affecting the impact consumption has on the planet. So the book argues that one of the best things we can do for the planet is buy the best products we can afford and make them last. Because however marvelous that cheap toaster may have been, if it's a piece of junk and you have to replace it in 5 years, where a good one would have lasted 20, then you've just quadrupled the size of the market for toasters with all of the plastic and metal and stainless steel that that implies. So my argument is quality might be one of the pillars of sustainable consumption.
And from your vantage point, do you think the consuming public can consume less in the years to come?
The book was timed in the belief that this was a very teachable moment, that we might be asking ourselves some hard questions about the way we consume. And there was lots of good data, you know, between 2009 and now that suggests that's the case. Who knows? I hope so. I mean, I begin the book with a reference to the Brundtland Report and the whole idea of sustainable development, and point out that when that was all over, it became okay for marketers to talk about being green, and everybody got engaged because there was a way to start. In that case, you know, with recycling, I'm hoping for the same thing here. If this can just enter the conversation, if we can just ask ourselves every once in a while when we go to the mall whether not only do we need what we're about to buy, but is what we're about to buy connected to the kind of corporate behavior we want to encourage? If we can even do that sometimes, we'll start our way back towards a more ethical way of consuming, given that we're not going to stop.
And the sort of power we have over brands, does that extend to greater choice in the marketplace, say, or the power to lower prices?
Well, I think we lower prices at our peril. The corporations are very adaptable creatures, and they don't usually impose any kind of moral judgment on what we say we want. But the fact is, you can drive so much value out of a product that companies are forced to find other ways to make it, and at a certain point, that can produce some pretty negative behavior. So if I could talk to every consumer in the world and suggest to them a message they want to take to their corporations, it wouldn't be make this stuff cheaper, it would be make it better.
And how do we do that? I mean, do we just go on Twitter and say, you know, like this thing that I bought sucks? And I mean, can that work as well if something does work? Or we like this brand, go on Twitter and say this is awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Right now, corporations are quite obsessed with social media, and they're listening very carefully. And literally, one voice can be heard and get a reaction from a lot of corporations. So, whether that remains true as we go forward and more people become involved and there's more noise and static in that space, hard to say. But I can tell you that there are a lot of big companies working very hard at finding a way to scale surveillance in social media to make sure that people we are being heard. And the reason for that is kind of intriguing. In the first instance, our sentiment about a brand affects its reputation, and that reputation affects its value. So that's not hard to kind of grasp. And it's pretty obvious. What's a little bit less obvious is that more and more commerce is being influenced by things as simple as search. And internet search, and we're talking here about things like Google, is blind to where the material it finds came from. And it'll sort it out according to its relevance and its credibility. But Google doesn't care if something that's said on the web was said by the manufacturer or was said by a customer. It'll still collect it up and index it, and it all becomes part of the portrait of what a brand stands for when somebody types it into a search box. So when we say things in social media, when we say things on a blog, or we say things on Twitter, we are contributing to the impression future customers will have of that brand before they put their money down in a very real way. And that's new.
I've done that. I've had run-ins with, I just had to think of the three companies that I've done that on Twitter, Shaw Cable, White Spot, and Staples. And there were three different experiences I had with each of them. And I just tweeted whatever happened. And within, I guess, 6 hours or so, you get a response from them.
Right.
Which is something, as you say, it's totally new. Does it, for them, they may not like to hear bad news, but I guess they have to, right?
Yeah, they do. And then they become very interested in taking that conversation offline so that no more damage gets
done. Yeah, I think, the recession, all of this seems to be a symptom of the recession. People tend to think that it's Wall Street's fault. But in the book, you talk about how Madison Avenue has taken some of the blame for it.
Yeah, when the recession really bit kind of on Main Street, there was a strong anti-marketing sentiment, particularly in the United States. I think as time went by and we all found out a bit more about Wall Street's role, the spotlight shifted away. But there was no question that people wanted somebody to be mad at, and that they saw this as somehow connected to consumption. And I think that's different from from previous recessions. I mean, I've been through a couple of big ones prior to this, which were essentially caused by consumers, if you like. They were recessions that were caused by changes in our consumption behavior for whatever reason, and that the industry had failed to anticipate and manage. And this one was different because we were generally victims of it. We didn't do it; it was kind of done to us. And that seemed to produce a couple of interesting results. One being that people were very aware of corporations and keen to open channels to them so that they could make their feelings known. And the other was that there was quite a lot of interesting dialogue around the morality of consumption. And that I had not seen before. I didn't remember that from the early 90s, and I didn't remember it from the early 80s. This was new. There was a kind of question about whether, this was really sustainable at all, and I mean that word in the largest possible sense. So it did feel different, and I think it's because of the way it happened to us.
And do you think we change after this, once we get out of this recession?
I hope so. We're not famous for making giant sea changes, and I wonder whether this whole thing has scared us enough. But there are some encouraging signs. There's no doubt about it. I look to the United States, for example, which is important because it's kind of the spiritual home of consumerism, and note that within sort of 18 months of the recession hitting, the U.S. saver had gone from being their savings rate was negative in the fall of 2008 to where now the country are actually bigger savers than Canadians are. That's a really quick behavior change, in social terms, and so it gives me some heart that that people are realizing that they're engaged in and affected by this system that we're talking about, and that they want to play a role.
It's been about, I guess, 11 years since Naomi Klein's No Logo. Mm-hmm. And it's for me, it's one of those books that everyone has, but I don't think most people have read. Is the message in there still relevant, do you think?
Well, I think a couple of gentle pokes at Naomi Klein in my book, but in fact, I think there were some important thinking done in that one. I read every word of it, and as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And I would say that we agree on two of three things. The first observation she makes is that it's become a branded world rather than an industrial world, and I think that's absolutely true, and that's how I experienced it as a marketer. And the second point she makes is that brands are the vulnerable, soft underbelly of corporations, and I think that's absolutely true, and my book argues the same thing forcefully. Where we come apart is on what ought to be done about it. And she promoted in that book a disengagement. Hit the streets, undermine brands, jam, marketing culture, opt out, don't give them your money, they're villains. And my contention is, first of all, if you do that, it's tantamount to giving up your vote in a democracy. And secondly, it isn't really very productive to think of corporations as villainous, even though villainous corporations certainly exist. It's more productive to think of them as big, dumb organisms that are bent on making money and will do whatever seems to work. And so, my argument is you should stay engaged in the system and make sure you're sending them signals they can understand.
But are they really dumb organisms? I mean, what worries me about monitoring of social media, is that they can use that against us eventually.
Well, I wonder if they can. I know it's very uncomfortable, But, you know, that's a reality of modern life. I mean, a lot of people don't know or choose not to consider the fact that when they use a search engine, their entire session on the Internet is tracked from the moment they type anything into that search box. And that's uncomfortable because we don't like to think we're being watched. But on the other hand, you know, we're not being watched by name, and the data that they're collecting is you know, turns around and gets used to make the Internet more useful to us, right? So we're trading a certain amount of privacy for a certain amount of value, and you know, that welcome to the 21st century. I mean, that's happening everywhere, from Facebook to Twitter, and so I'm kind of philosophical about it. I like the power it gives me, so I'll accept the, you know, the loss of privacy. I don't see that it would be in any corporation's interest to use that information to actually harm us. You know, I think at one point in the book I say even biker gangs ultimately need satisfied customers to stay in business.
Yeah. Say, do you like Mad Men?
I do.
Yeah. Is it all true from having worked inside the business? Is it what goes on there?
Yeah, I think it once was. I mean, what you see on Mad Men is absolutely a creature of the mass corporate controlled media era. You know, I think I mentioned at one point in the book that in 1958 or 59, you could buy advertising time on more than one television show that would reach more than 50% of the viewing adults in North America. Those kind of ratings aren't possible anymore. You know, we have far more stuff to choose from and far more control over how it's delivered to us. So the idea that Madison Avenue has this power is, and that the process is so simple, is an artifact of that media time. It isn't anymore, and I can tell you that the industry is frantically trying to reinvent itself for the new realities.
I really enjoyed this book, Bruce. Good luck with it, and thanks for this.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for your interest.
You're very welcome. The websites for more, brucephilp.com and brandcowboy.com. The book is called Consumer Republic, Using Brands to Get What You Want, Make Corporations Behave, and Maybe Even Save the World. It's published by McClelland & Stewart. It's author Bruce Philp on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.